This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Sand and Sky, Desert Archetypes in Speculative Fiction.
The desert.
Does it immediately make you think of Lawrence of Arabia?
Sort of. Actually, I kind of just get sort of like horrific flashbacks of all the times I went into the desert. Have you ever been to the desert, Jules?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I've been several times. I've been to the Sahara and all sorts. We used to go camping out in the desert. And one thing I can tell you is that sand gets everywhere. And I mean everywhere. Several weeks after I'd come back, I think it was actually several months after I'd come back from a camping trip we took into the desert, I got this terrible ear infection, and the doctor sort of was like, all right, let's have a look inside. And he looked inside my ear and he said, oh my God, there are sort of granules in there. And I'm like, yeah, it's sand. And he's there like, how have you been to the beach recently? I was like, no, I was in the desert like 5 weeks ago, but it's never coming out.
Yeah, see, I do know that from having lived by the sea for quite a long time. And whenever you had, almost unseasonably strong winds and things, you'd find sand everywhere. If you left the window of your flat open, there'd be sand on everything. So, yeah.
Yeah, it really does get everywhere. But it is a very mysterious place, the desert. And it's an incredible place, actually. There's really nowhere quite in the world which is quite like the desert, the whole aesthetic of it. And all sort of sand up your ass jokes aside, there is this rawness about the desert, which it feels different from the rawness you kind of get from other natural habitats.
Yeah.
And I think probably the big problem is that a lot of people, when they think of the desert, they have a very single image in their mind of this just barren, monotonous landscape that just goes on and on and on and on forever. And there's always like a cow skull somewhere, because never the rest of the cow. I mean, what happened to the rest of the cow?
Yeah, that's the Wild West thing, isn't it?
yeah. They just have just the cow skull. But it's not like that at all. It's an incredibly varied landscape, which is full of life, but maybe not to the extent that you think. I don't know. It's kind of that there is a lot of life that goes on there, but it's not life that we're usually familiar with, especially here in the UK. And it's very varied. There's a lot of different kind of vegetation, and the horizon changes. And I think probably one of the most magical things for me, I remember standing at the top of a sand dune with my mother. We were looking out over this whole sea of dunes. And of course, when the wind blows, the dunes move. They don't stay still, they move. And I just thought that was the most incredible thing ever. I just stood at the top there and I thought, it's like a sea. It's like an ocean. It just moves at a different time to us. But these dunes move. And there was this kind of, I was suddenly very in touch with this idea of why people were so connected with the desert. And the other thing, of course, is the night sky. And you don't see the night sky anywhere like you see it when you're in the desert.
No.
So yeah, we decided we'd talk a little bit about the desert and how it's represented in fiction, and some of the kind of the similar sort of themes that we get from how deserts are written. I feel it's worth mentioning again. We've talked about this before, but one thing it's pointed out in Hamish Steele's Pantheon is that Egypt, the rule for Egypt was divided between Horus and Set before it was given to the humans. And Set rules 97% of Egypt, except 97% of Egypt is the desert. So Set rules the desert, and Set is this kind of trickster character that we've kind of mentioned before, which I think is rather appropriate because there is this trickery about the desert. And we'll probably go into that in a little bit. So, Jules, let's start with you. What have you read, seen, watched recently, which has involved deserts?
Recently, I'm not sure, but a good access point for most people would probably be Star Wars, because you've got Tatooine that shows up in at least four of the three of the films. Three or four of them. And yes, you know, that's quite an easy, as I said, it's an easy access point, and it's not necessarily representative of the desert in speculative fiction as a whole.
But
you get the idea of this quite hard landscape that's unforgiving of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it does play into the archetype whereby heroes are forged and tested by there's a sort of old tradition where heroes are sort of cast out and into a desert type atmosphere, or an actual desert, and the idea is that the sun sort of burns off all the impurities, and if they survive, then they're 100 times stronger than they were before.
Yeah.
So it does play into that archetype a little bit, because you've got Luke, who obviously comes from there, and then later Rey as well.
Yeah.
And it's quite telling in the original trilogy that you've got Luke leaving there to go off and find his destiny, and then going back there to embrace his destiny to say, no, I've become a Jedi kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And yet there is one of the interesting things about Tatooine is that there are two moons.
Yes.
Which I kind of like, the idea that there are two moons, because this was raised, actually, by Liam, who was saying that the building of the Death Star, how did it affect the lunar gravitational pull on some of the planets that it was close to?
Well, yeah, you'd think that somebody would have noticed.
And then, you know, I suddenly thought, but Tatooine, of course, has got two moons, but it doesn't have any water. It's a complete desert planet, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I recall from the canon, most of the water's extracted using moisture extractors, you know, from the air and things. There must be some, otherwise there wouldn't be any plants at all. But
yeah,
they sort of harvest it out of the air.
So there's that. but yeah, it's the sky, the fact that it has two moons, which I find kind of fascinating. Because again, one of the big things about the desert is the sand and the night sky. So it was quite nice that they decided to add that. I mean, I guess what they were really trying to say is that this is a really foreign, very alien place. It's even got two moons, you know, that we're not used to at all. But I find it interesting that that's how they decided to show it. Because they could have said that a desert planet, they could have just done the easy thing and said it has two suns.
I mean, it does make me chuckle just a little bit, the moon scenario, is the fact that we're sort of like 84% water.
Mm-hmm.
The moon actually affects us. It tends to make us more emotional when it's full. It was very noticeable, certainly working in accident and emergency, that an awful lot of women who weren't expecting to give birth yet turned up in accident and emergency and just sort of like dropped one on the doorstep, as it were. There's also the whole lunacy thing. There's a reason that people with specific mental illnesses, the blanket term madness, they were called lunatics because the moon affected them. And I don't know what the whole correlation is. I don't think anybody's really studied it. But it is very, very noticeable that, and this is talking to a lot of the psychiatric wards and things around where I used to work, they said on full moon night and the day before and after, the people who were most likely to have just sort of break out, you know, the people who had really bad schizophrenia, for example, and various other things, that happened then. It was in conjunction with that. So,
yeah.
And this was almost across the board. It was very, very strange. And again, people who tended towards slightly more mental disturbance than others, again, you'd see them in accident emergency, you'd see more people trying to commit suicide around that time as well. So,
yeah.
As an aside, from that logic, I'm thinking, so are the people of Tatooine a bit more emotional than the rest of the Star Wars universe?
I mean, just look at Luke, so.
Yeah. How much of that is him being sort of bratty just post-teenager, and how much of it is there's two moons?
There's two moons myself. Here. Just, he leaves and he's suddenly like, oh, I'm much calmer now.
It's like, I'm chill. There's no moon. It's like, no, Luke, you can freak out about the Death Star. That's fine. It's like, no, I'm fine. There's no moon.
So, yeah. Good.
Anyway, sidestep there. Yeah, so as I said, easy access point for desert with Tatooine. Right. It is noticeable that George Lucas pretty much nicked that idea from Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune. Dune did not get made into a film as soon, possibly because it's quite an in-depth and complicated story. As in, you have to pay attention to what's going on. It's very, very clever, but it's not like a fairy tale in space in the same way that Star Wars is.
No.
And I know I've mentioned Dune before because it's one of my favourite books, but how much do you know about the whole setup? You know, it's a desert planet.
Yes, I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Very little otherwise.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Dune universe, for those who don't know, functions entirely around this one spice melange, which is only found on Arrakis, which is the desert planet, Dune. And Dune was colonised originally, in the same way we kind of colonised Australia, by sending convicts there, who eventually formed their own tribes and things, called the Fremen. And Dune was so incredibly hard to live on and colonise that they became a very hardened, warlike people in the end. And they are kind of treated like second-class citizens, partly because people need them to stay in their place, because it would be really difficult to train people to mine the spice melange.
Yeah.
Now, aside from the fact that Dune's a desert planet, there's hardly any water there, and it's very, very difficult to survive, just in general, Dune is also populated by these giant sandworms called, you know, known to the Fremen as Shai-Hulud. And they are humongous. They tend to be sort of like well over 100 feet long, capable of swallowing a spaceship. And they're attracted to vibration, anything. So obviously you've seen worms in your garden, maybe after the rain. Worms feel the vibrations through the earth and will rise to the surface with the rain because they will go towards moisture.
Yeah.
Shai-Hulud does the same thing, except it is so sensitive. It could be 50 miles away and feel your footsteps in the desert because it, you know, it's rhythmic. So the Fremen have had to learn to walk in a way that mimics the normal sound of shifting sand.
Cool.
So it basically, if you haven't sort of grown up learning the Fremen's ways, you are dead if you end up in the desert there. There's no, you might walk out of it alive. You are really screwed. Anyway, the whole universe is based around this, the fight for control over the spice melange, because the spice, oh God, I'm going to quote the film now. the spice extends consciousness. The spice prolongs life. The spice permits space travel. That is, travelling without moving. The spice is everything. It's petrol, it's drugs, it's the most exquisite delicacy. It's everything that everybody wants. And it's only found in this one place. Basically, their entire society would grind to a halt if they didn't have any, you know, if they used it all up. And then there's an ecological element in it, because the Fremen actually think, well, we'd quite like a bit more water and a bit easier time getting food.
Yeah, so fair enough.
They're sort of planning this big jihad to get their freedom and to basically ecologically change parts of Dune, not realising that by doing that they're going to endanger the sandworms and come close to making them extinct. This is later on in the series. But the whole thing is just open to lots of moral questions. And I do like the main character, Paul Atreides, Muad'Dib. He's an absolutely great character. But as he rightly points out himself in the second book, Dune Messiah, he's got a kill ratio that makes Hitler look like Mother Teresa. And it's a case of, no, I've killed hundreds of thousands to save billions kind of thing. And he's not trying to justify it to himself. He's just like, everybody's lauding me as a hero, but I'd like to point out that, you know, the Holocaust looks like nothing compared to what I've done.
Yeah, fun.
So, no, absolutely great books. And I think, again, it does feed into the whole, I mean, they actually say God built Arrakis to test the faithful. So once again, if you're found worthy, then you will be able to survive. Now, part of that's playing into the whole Missionaria Protectiva, which is there's this group of women called the Bene Gesserit, who basically set up seed religions in case any of them end up on the wrong planet, so that they can like nurture a religion into life and use it to get things accomplished, which is incredibly sneaky, but also very effective. But it's also a case of, I think it really does still play, and even more so than Star Wars, into that ethos of, you know, the desert burns away impurities and what you're left with is the real metal.
Yeah, but there's something else as well, which I find quite interesting, and it's how Western society depicts the desert compared to actually what cultures are like in the desert.
Yeah.
And Western society in general tend to depict the desert as a very mean place, which breeds very mean and efficient people.
Yeah.
When actually, desert societies, yes, it's a harsh environment which is difficult to live in, but it actually therefore breeds some of the kindest people in society. Nomads are incredibly generous people, and actually it brings out again, I think it calls into question what human nature is actually like. And you know, the whole survival of the fittest thing, you know, we've talked about this before. It's not actually survival of the fittest, it's survival of communities, which is when people work together, they can survive. So actually, you tend to find very kind people who are charitable and very friendly and communicative and bright in the desert, and some very bright and amazing cultures that you might not necessarily get elsewhere.
No, I can see that. It is kind of referred to with the Fremen, but it's a case of once you're recognised as one of them, then you know, you have as much status as you can hold within the group, and there's lots of different groups of Fremen, and they will all work together. It's the overlords they've really got a problem with, understandably.
Yeah.
So yeah, you get an element of that, and it's all a case of, well, we all know we have to depend on each other to survive. There are aspects of it that are harsh, and to be honest, I don't think Arrakis is really based on actual desert.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
There's very little there at all except sandworms.
Yeah, except these huge sandworms. Can they eat the sandworms, though? That is the question.
Well, actually, they kind of worship the sandworm as god.
Oh, okay.
but they do drown the sandworm larvae in order to make something called the Water of Life, because once sandworms reach a certain point in their cycle, they can no longer tolerate the presence of water.
Ah.
Which is where you get into the whole ecology thing. But
right, got it. Okay. But yeah, so again, quite interesting how Western society depicts the desert versus how the desert appears in a lot of kind of how the desert really is in a lot of places. And I think one of the main things about the desert is that you do not survive the desert on your own.
No. Well, I'm sure there have been people who've come out, but you know, not ideal.
Yeah, no, but you can survive, but as in, like, you don't go and live in the desert on your own.
No.
There are a few animals that can live in the desert on their own, but for the most part, it's animals that survive best in the desert kind of go in packs.
Yeah, it tends to be the smaller animals, doesn't it, that survive on their own.
Yeah. Also, yeah, the desert has got snakes. This is the interesting thing, which is that I was looking at sort of desert mythology, and most of the mythology circles around snakes. Almost exclusively, you have snakes and then you have scorpions. And those are the two big things. At no point whilst I have been in the desert have I ever encountered a snake. I've seen scorpions, but again, not really in the desert. Never seen a snake, never seen a scorpion. But you know what creature I did come across in the desert several times? Dogs. And they chased me. And I was not happy about it.
They're wild dogs?
We didn't know. Some of them are wild dogs. Some of them belonged to the nomads and were just kind of in the area and were just playing. So, but you get dogs in the desert. And camels, obviously. Lots and lots of camels. Brief thing about camels, don't go near them. Camels are, like most big animals, they look kind of cool, but they're awful, and they don't want to be your friend. Camels really do not want to be your friend.
They're really quite grumpy, aren't they?
They're very grumpy, and to be honest, I can understand why. It's hard enough living as a camel without someone trying to get onto your back, okay? So they're grumpy, they spit, they bite, they kick, they're just in general. They're amazing creatures, and I know someone who keeps camels and loves them to bits. But from my experience, I just think, great, camel, you stay over there, and I'll stay over here. And that's that. So, admire from afar.
Yes. No, I'd agree with that. that when they spit, that what the chemicals contained in their spit reek to high heaven.
Yes, they do.
You really, really don't want that.
Nope, and it sticks to you. It really sticks to you. Good.
So, yes, we've covered camels. Obviously, I mean, it's worth mentioning there's obviously different types of desert. The sort of desert you get around, say, Mexico, for example, is different to what you... the Sahara, which is different again to the tundra. The tundra is actually a type of desert, even though it's cold.
Yeah. And actually, there's a relationship between kind of ice deserts and sand deserts. And actually, talking about camels, I was talking about the ecological side, rather the biological, which is that I was talking about this with Sean, and he was saying that there might be some evidence that points to camels having evolved in cold temperatures to survive sort of like barren, sort of like icy, snowy places. And that's actually how they evolved. But it just so happens that most of the things they evolved to be able to survive in those kind of conditions help them out in sandy conditions. So the way their feet are shaped, the way they store water. And the desert, it sounds obvious, but the only thing that really makes the desert hot is the sun.
It's cold at night.
It's very cold at night. And you do get snow in the desert as well. That is a thing that does happen. So it's very cold at night. And it is quite an amazing place. It really must be said. But you would not want to be lost out there. That's for sure. And there are lots and lots of different kinds of deserts. What else? Moving away from sort of sci-fi, because we'll just stick onto sci-fi just for a second. Another kind of desert that we see a lot of in sci-fi is actually Mars.
I was about to say Mars, and the Martian actually is a good example.
Yeah. Why don't you talk about that?
Okay. Oh, the name's gone out of my head. The Martian is a book that was originally published. It was originally self-published just because the guy had a real interest in space.
Yeah.
So he basically was setting himself problems and then solving them. And he published it on his blog. And it was just so popular that Andy Weir, that's who wrote it. There we go. It was so popular that he said, OK, well, I'll put it all together and self-publish it, not meaning to start a writing career out of it at all. And then it got picked up by a publisher. And then very shortly after that, it got picked up for a film, which obviously starred Matt Damon. It's a good film. And it's a really good book as well. It's difficult to sustain somebody's interest that long when you have a single character by themselves. He's basically a Robinson Crusoe in space, except so much better than Robinson Crusoe, because Robinson Crusoe's a git. do not like Robinson Crusoe. But it's that whole idea of being stranded on a desert island. Not the romantic, oh, I'd have all the time to read I want kind of thing. There'd be coconuts. But genuinely, your survival depends just on what you know and scratching something out from day to day. In his case, he not only has to find water or a way to make water, which gets interesting, he has to find a way to make food grow. There's no bacteria in Martian soil, to the best of our knowledge from samples. That means you can't grow anything in it because there's no nitrogen production.
Yeah, so fun stuff.
Fun stuff. Have you ever seen the film?
I've seen clips of it.
Yeah. Anyway, basically he manages to get his own dried and the crew's dried shit, which has been packaged up, soil from outside, mix it all together, because obviously we produce a fair bit of bacteria and we do contain some of the right bacteria for growing stuff in soil.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to have one bag of potatoes that has been saved, actual potatoes rather than the freeze-dried stuff that astronauts usually eat.
Yeah.
And he plants them and he manages to start this rotational potato crop. It's really very clever. I mean, what I took away from that film was, if you're going to get stranded on Mars, be a botanist.
That's one of the lines. It's like, I don't mean to boast, but I think I might be the best botanist on Mars. Something like that.
Yep, something like that. And oxygen. He has to make his own oxygen, for God's sake.
Oh, fun times.
And it is a really amazing story about survival and overcoming the odds. And you could really argue there that that also plays into the archetype of the desert was created to test the faithful, to test the worthy. Because that's exactly what happens.
Yeah. Speaking of which, there is a new sci-fi series out, which I think is called Oasis. But I might be wrong in that. Let me just... Yeah, because I think it's based on a book by Michael Faber. called The Book of Strange New
Oh God,
Things.
that book.
And of my understanding, yeah, I'm not sure it's set on Mars, but it's set on a planet, yeah.
It's a non-differentiated planet that they're trying to colonize, and there are native creatures there already, which are most distinctly not human.
And it's got a desert like, I mean, yeah, it's a desert without any kind of a lot of forms of there doesn't seem to be really any form of life, no vegetation or anything like that. But there is water underground, and so they're drilling. And what happens is that they call up a priest. The guy in charge basically calls for a priest, who's one of the guys who is against people going and trying to colonize this planet, and they say, look, the guys need a man of faith who's up here. So the priest arrives, only to discover that the man in charge has just disappeared entirely.
I think they've taken the sketchiest outline of Faber's book and run in a
Yeah,
different
no.
direction by
Yeah,
the
no.
sounds of it.
Yeah, no. This is yeah, so the in this Yeah, no, I think I'm getting it right. I might be mixing two together. But yeah, the character is called Peter Lay, and he's played by Richard Madden, who's an excellent actor. And yeah, so what happens is he arrives there, and something, and there are these accidents happening. People just keep getting into accidents, and they keep hallucinating whilst they're out and about. And what happens is they keep hallucinating some of the worst, the kind of their sort of worst memory. So one character, for instance, says he has been hallucinating about a horse that he owned, a racehorse, this little foal that he absolutely loved. And just before its first race, he suddenly had a moment of, oh, I don't think it's going to cut it. So he had a vet come in to give it a boost the night before. And then the horse was winning, and it collapsed about 10 meters from the finishing line, and its heart had basically given out. And now this guy keeps hallucinating this beautiful foal, and then finally he's in the middle of drilling something, and he suddenly sees this lovely horse coming towards him, and he puts his hand out to pat it. And of course, what he does is he puts his hand into the drill. So that's fun. But it's an interesting one. And again, I feel a bit uneasy about this marriage between the desert and faith. But it brings up that interesting thing, which is illusions.
Yeah, obviously I can't comment on the series, but the book is very much it is about illusions, but it's quite a scathing commentary on how faith is used to manipulate people who we perceive to have a far more limited understanding of the wider world or the wider universe. There's some real kick in the teeth type stuff that I can't say I actually liked the book, but it was quite clever. And I hated the main character because he was sanctimonious, self-righteous, did not have a problem with actually going and colonizing somewhere at all. Really, really, generally nasty piece of work, and he was worse because he thought he was saved and righteous and all the rest of it.
Well, I haven't really watched much of the series because, as you know, I'm not a big sort of sci-fi fan. But I kind of I saw into it a little bit because I was really interested in the way that they'd done the environment and this kind of this inclusion of illusions. And there's an interesting thing because it's something you get in the sea and in the desert, which is these hallucinations. And I guess there's a kind of a relationship between those two environments because it's this endlessness, isn't it?
Yeah, and part of that is it obviously it tricks your eye. Your brain's a modelling system and it will take what information you give it to try and make sense of it. And if you just give it something it can't make sense of, which is an endless horizon, it will try and provide something to break up that line. And then if you add to that something like dehydration or too much sun or too much glare off the sea, then things get quite interesting.
So it's but it is it, it I really like this this thing because the things happen in the desert. Weird things happen in the desert that you don't that can't always necessarily be explained. I mean, they can all be explained, but it's not just illusions, it's that natural things will happen, which kind of sort of make you do a double take. Sandstorms and little kind of, what are they called? Are they wind devils?
Dust devils.
Dust devils. Those occur out of nowhere, and they're really weird and frightening and wonderful to look at. And they look like they do have a mind of their own, like you're witnessing something that is alive. And the desert has this kind of life to it, which makes you feel like it is just one giant monster.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously the desert is coupled with that famous illusion, which is the mirage.
Yes.
And again, there is a complete scientific explanation for mirages. But having seen mirages myself, you know, I used to think, how could anyone, like, how do mirages work? But I've seen mirages and I've seen what they look like. And it is so weird. It really does look like water. And you can understand how a tired mind or someone who is desperately thirsty would see that and kind of rush forward toward it.
Yeah. And it is, as an interesting aside, you will also hallucinate in extremes of cold as well.
Yeah.
I think when we talked about climbing mountains before, that's something that can happen with altitude sickness. If you go to somewhere where, once again, you have extremes of cold and you're just surrounded again by infinite ice, then you can get something pretty much like an ice mirage where you start seeing, you know, light or fire or something in the distance. Your brain will try and interpret what it sees into something that it thinks your body wants.
Yeah.
Because I suppose, again, an ice field is, once again, a kind of desert, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Another reason why, actually, that the desert is often coupled with this mysticism and this magic is, once more, going back to the night sky and what you can see of the night sky, which is that the number of shooting stars. it's crazy. You can see hundreds in a night. Okay, that's an exaggeration, but there are a lot of them. There are million shooting stars. You can see the Milky Way. You can see so much of the night sky. And the night sky can produce some pretty amazing kind of effects anyway. But when there's really nothing else to break it up, and I mean really nothing, there's no light pollution at all, what you end up seeing is incredible. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if you started to apply things to that. And the desert as well has a reputation because of the mythology that's attached to it, which I think has marked how we see the desert ever since.
Yeah.
So I think, and probably one of the best ones is ancient Egyptian mythology and pharaohs and mummies and scarabs. And things like that.
Yeah, that was a film I was going to mention, actually, which is The Mummy.
The one
with Brandon Fraser and Rachel Weisz.
Great film.
I've always had a soft spot for. I'm pretty sure that they've pretty much interpreted Egyptian mythology to suit themselves there, but I still really like the film.
Yeah, it's incredibly inaccurate, but it doesn't matter because they're really just poking fun.
Tongue is firmly in the cheek there. And there are parts of that that are genuinely quite creepy. The idea that you might bury somebody alive in the desert is, well, I mean, I found that quite disturbing. Burying someone alive at all is pretty disturbing.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that.
But entombing some... Okay, as a punishment, do you think making somebody immortal and putting them in a tomb in the desert is a really good idea? You know, someone who's already quite powerful. That's the bit where it really fell down for me.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
It's like, oh, but we'll put a warning on it. You know, in 2,000 years when nobody can read hieroglyphs any longer. This is why you don't play with your food. If you have to kill someone, you just do it.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Jules's wisdom for the day.
Yeah.
Don't play with your food, just kill them. Yes. Now I'm concerned about what your food is.
There was also the book I read a while back, The Golem and the Djinn.
Yes.
Which does have a few scenes from the djinn's point of view in the desert, understandably, because you find out how he came to be imprisoned in a mortal form. And that all had to do with pretty much impregnating a local tribesman's daughter. But he was a young djinn and he was curious and they were fond of each other. It just sort of kind of happened. But I think they captured this idea of desert tribes that generally work together on kindness and on everybody sort of occupying their place much better than perhaps some of the other Western speculative fiction has done. So just as a mention.
That's good to know. I might have to check that out. Well, I've got that one book is on my reading list anyway. But yeah.
And there's one I read last year. I'm actually starting the second book now because I was given an art copy. It's The Rebel of the Sands by Alwyn Hamilton, which has garnered some criticism, but it's a fantasy. And it plays into some of the stereotypes that have been built up from Western perspective on deserts. But I think she also has... what's interesting is the desert is a shelter for this group of rebels who are trying to overthrow the emperor. And they have demi-djinn and things like that working with them as well. And the main character, Amani, is a gunslinger, which is awesome because it's kind of like West meets East kind of thing. And she is a really good character, full stop. And she discovers later on in the book that she can actually literally raise the sands against people to defend herself. So it's kind of like the desert embraces her and embraces this group, and it's just a really, really good fast-paced fantasy. I think that's one of the things, really, if you go into it expecting absolute accuracy, then you're probably going to be disappointed because it is supposed to be a fantasy. But I wouldn't have said she didn't do her due diligence and try to represent people properly. It's a good
I'll
book.
Have to check that out. But deserts are fascinating places, I think that there is a kind of misunderstanding of what they really, really do look like and how they are depicted. But at the same time, some people really aren't wrong.
No. Obviously, there's very few areas where there's absolutely no life whatsoever. And what's really interesting is, obviously, I've never seen this in person, but, that's what David Attenborough's for, where you do get one of the main rains that happens sort of in springtime in the desert, and all the flowers suddenly burst into bloom, and it's just this riot of colour and green, and it might only last 2 or 3 days and it's gone again.
Yeah.
But it completely transforms the entire desert.
I think one of the most amazing things about living in a desert country, which, I've lived in several desert countries, is actually the way that the desert just appears. And you look out and you see city, 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 greenery, 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 and then there's just nothing. It's just green, and then there's a line, and there's desert, and that's it.
Yep.
And where there are no houses, there's just desert. You really didn't have to go far. The moment you reach the end of the city, there was no kind of in-between state. It was just city or desert. There was nothing else. And it is amazing because the desert is prevailing and mysterious, and you are right, you get this rainfall and suddenly oasis, and then it's gone just like that.
Yeah, it really is blink and you'd miss it. And obviously from the plant's perspective, it's kind of like quick, we've got water, we need to procreate. But
procreate and death. And oases are pretty amazing. We've been to a few of those as well. And it is just this sudden patch of green in the middle of beige. So, it's an incredible place. And I think that everyone should go to the desert at some point in their lives. Because it really is different. Very, very different.
In my case,
the people are very friendly.
So in my case, covered from head to toe in total sunblock.
Yeah. I mean, we do have a few funny stories. I've got so many funny stories from our trips to the desert where things have not gone well. Sand aside, if you do go to the desert, take a good guide. You want a good guide with you, someone who really knows it and someone who can really kind of do your research before you go out there. because you do not want to be stuck out there on your own with no idea how to get back.
No, definitely not.
So I guess all that's left is to be asked, if you could visit any desert in the world, which desert would you go to?
Well, I'd probably pick a tundra, actually.
Okay.
So somewhere up in Alaska. I'm built for the cold. I'm not built for lots and lots of sun, I'm afraid.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I would be better with that. And also the sort of creatures that live around tundra fascinate me. So lynx and snowshoe hare and wolves and even the lichens and things like that interest me a lot more.
Fair enough. I guess it's hard to say. I wouldn't mind going back to the Sahara because it's so unbelievably huge. And I mean, the Egyptian desert in general is fascinating.
See, I think I'd like to see it for about 5 minutes and then I'd want to go inside.
Yeah.
It's one of those things I'd like to see in person, but I wouldn't want to spend any length of time there.
Yeah. Well, I lived in Cairo for 2 years and we used to go riding in the desert around the pyramids. And that was really special.
Yeah.
It was really, really special. And I guess a part of me kind of misses that and sort of I'm drawn back to it, because as much as I used to complain about the sand, there is really no parallel to riding through the dunes, just like flight. I've ridden in all sorts of places, but the desert, it's just unparalleled. Just unparalleled.
Is this camel or horse?
Horse, not camel. I rode a camel in the desert as well and regretted my decision.
They have an interesting gait.
They have a very interesting gait. And it's also really interesting getting on to the camel. So you get on the camel and then you're like, okay, it's fine. And it's kneeling on the ground and then it gets up. And when it gets down as well, what happens is it tips all the way back and then it tips all the way forward. And it's really not fun. Do not recommend. So yeah. Yeah, definitely a magical place. Well worth visiting at least once. So there we go. And on that note.
That's us for this week.
We'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.